This is Audible.
Wiley presents the following for traders at all levels of experience looking to improve their proficiency and maximize returns. Wiley trading books, videos, and tools provide you with information on the markets, instruments, strategies, and tactics that will aid you in succeeding in the markets. Our trading resources are supported by free educational material available at our website, WileyTrading.com.
Reminiscences of a Stock Operator by Edwin Lefebvre. To Jesse Lauriston, Livermore. I went to work when I was just out of grammar school. I got a job as a quotation board boy in a stock brokerage office. I was quick at figures. At school, I did 3 years of arithmetic in one. I was particularly good at mental arithmetic. As quotation board boy, I posted the numbers on the big board in the customer's room. One of the customers usually sat by the ticker and called out the prices. They couldn't come too fast for me. I have always remembered figures, no trouble at all. There were plenty of other employees in that office. Of course, I made friends with the other fellows, but the work I did, if the market was active, kept me too busy from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. to let me do much talking. I don't care for it anyhow, during business hours. But a busy market did not keep me from thinking about the work. Those quotations did not represent prices of stocks to me, so many dollars per share. They were numbers. Of course, they meant something. They were always changing. It was all I had to be interested in, the changes. Why did they change? I didn't know. I didn't care. I didn't think about it. I simply saw that they changed. That is how I first came to be interested in the behavior of prices. I had a very good memory for figures. I could remember in detail how the prices had acted on the previous day, just before they went up or down. My fondness for mental arithmetic came in very handy. I noticed that in advances as well as declines, stock prices were apt to show certain habits, so to speak. There was no end of parallel cases, and these made precedents to guide me. I was only 14, but after I had taken hundreds of observations in my mind, I found myself testing their accuracy, comparing the behavior of stocks today with other days. It was not long before I was anticipating movements in prices. My only guide, as I say, was their past performances. I carried the dope sheets in my mind. I looked for stock prices to run on form. I had clocked them. You know what I mean. You can spot, for instance, where the buying is only a trifle better than the selling. A battle goes on in the stock market, and the tape is your telescope. You can depend upon it 7 out of 10 cases. Another lesson I learned early is that there is nothing new in Wall Street. There can't be, because speculation is as old as the hills. Whatever happens in the stock market today has happened before and it will happen again. I've never forgotten that. I got so interested in my game and so anxious to anticipate advances and declines in all the active stocks that I got a little book. I put down my observations in it. Say that after studying every fluctuation of the day in an active stock, I would conclude that it was behaving as it always did before it broke 8 or 10 points. Well, I would jot down the stock and the price on Monday, and remembering past performances, I would write down what it ought to do on Tuesday and Wednesday. Later, I would check up with actual transcriptions from the tape. That is how I first came to take an interest in the message of the tape. The fluctuations were from the first associated in my mind with upward or downward movements. Of course, there is always a reason for fluctuations, but the tape does not concern itself with the why and the wherefore. It doesn't go into explanations. I didn't ask the tape why when I was 14, and I don't ask it today at 40. The reason for what a certain stock does today may not be known for 2 or 3 days or weeks or months. But what the dickens does that matter? Your business with the tape is now, not tomorrow. The reason can wait. But you must act instantly or be left. Time and again, I see this happen. Well, I kept up my little memorandum book perhaps 6 months. Instead of leaving for home the moment I was through with my work, I'd jot down the figures I wanted and would study the changes, always looking for the repetitions and parallelisms of behavior, learning to read the tape, although I was not aware of it at the time. One day, one of the office boys, he was older than I, came to me where I was eating my lunch and asked me, on the quiet, if I had any money. "Why do you want to know?" I said. "Well," he said, "I've got a dandy tip on Burlington. I'm going to play it if I can get somebody to go in with me." "How do you mean play it?" I asked. "I'm going to buy all the Burlington the bucket shop will let me carry with the money I give him for margin," he said. "It's going up, sure. It's like picking up money. We'll double ours in a jiffy." "Hold on," I said to him, and pulled out my little dope book. I wasn't interested in doubling my money, but in his saying that Burlington was going up, if it was, my notebook ought to show it. I looked. Sure enough, Burlington, according to my figuring, was acting as it usually did before it went up. I had never bought or sold anything in my life, and I never gambled with the other boys. But all I could see was that this was a grand chance to test the accuracy of my work, of my hobby. It struck me at once that if my dope didn't work in practice, there was nothing in the theory of it to interest anybody. So I gave him all I had, and with our pooled resources, he went to one of the nearby bucket shops and bought some Burlington. 2 days later, we cashed in. I made a profit of $3.12. After that first trade, I got to speculating on my own hook in the bucket shops. I'd go during my lunch hour and buy or sell. It never made any difference to me. I was playing a system and not a favorite stock or backing opinions. It was not long before I was taking much more money out of the bucket shops than I was pulling down from my job in the brokerage office, so I gave up my position. My folks objected, but they couldn't say much when they saw what I was making. I was only a kid, and office boy wages were not very high. I did mighty well on my own hook. I was 15 when I had my first $1,000 and laid the cash in front of my mother, all made in the bucket shops in a few months, besides what I had taken home. My mother carried on something awful. She wanted me to put it away in the savings bank, out of reach of temptation. She said it was more money than she ever heard any boy of 15 had made, starting with nothing. She didn't quite believe it was real money. She used to worry and fret about it. But I didn't think of anything except that I could keep on proving my figuring was right. That's all the fun there is, being right by using your head. If I was right when I tested my convictions with 10 shares, I would be 10 times more right if I traded in 100 shares. That is all that having more margin meant to me. I was right more emphatically. Anyhow, at 15, I was making a good living out of the stock market. I began in the smaller bucket shops where the man who traded in 20 shares at a clip was suspected of being John W. Gates in disguise or J.P. Morgan traveling incognito. I didn't have a following. I kept my business to myself. I couldn't see where I needed to tell my business to anybody else. I've got friends, of course, but my business has always been the same, a one-man affair. That's why I have always played a lone hand. As it was, it didn't take long for the bucket shops to get sore on me for beating them. I'd walk in and plank down my margarine, but they'd look at it without making a move to grab it. They'd tell me there was nothing doing. That was the time they got to calling me the boy plunger. I had to be changing brokers all the time, going from one bucket shop to another. It got so that I had to give a fictitious name. I'd begin light, only 15 or 20 shares. At times, when they got suspicious, I'd lose on purpose at first, and then sting them proper. Of course, after a little while, they'd find me too expensive, and they'd tell me to take myself and my business elsewhere and not interfere with the owner's dividends. Once, when the big concern I'd been trading with for months shut down on me, I made up my mind to take a little more of their money away from them. That bucket shop had branches all over the city, in hotel lobbies and in nearby towns. I went to one of the hotel branches and asked the manager a few questions and finally got to trading. But as soon as I played an active stock my special way, he began to get messages from the head office asking who it was that was operating. The manager told me what they asked him, and I told him my name was Edward Robinson of Cambridge. He telephoned the glad news to the big chief, but the other end wanted to know what I looked like. When the manager told me that, I said to him, "Tell him I'm a short, fat man with dark hair and a bushy beard." But he described me instead, and then he listened, and his face got red and he hung up and told me to beat it. "What did they say to you?" I asked him, politely. "They said, 'You blankety-blank fool, didn't we tell you to take no business from Larry Livingston?' And you deliberately let him trim us out of $700. He didn't say what else they told him. I tried the other branches, one after another, but they all got to know me, and my money wasn't any good in any of their offices. Finally, there was only one left to me, and that was the biggest and richest of all, the Cosmopolitan Stock Brokerage Company. The Cosmopolitan was rated as A1 and did an enormous business. It had branches in every manufacturing town in New England. They took my trading all right, and I bought and sold stocks and made and lost money for months, but in the end, it happened with them, as usual. They didn't refuse my business point blank, as the small concerns had, but they did the next worst thing. That is, they made me put up a 3-point margin and compelled me to pay a premium at first of a 0.5 point, then a point, and finally a 1.5 points. Some handicap, that. How? Easy. Suppose steel was selling at 90 and you bought it. Your ticket read normally, "Bought 10 steel at 90 1/8". If you put up a 1-point margin, it meant that if it broke 89 1/4, you were wiped out automatically. In a bucket shop, the customer is not importuned for more margin or put to the painful necessity of telling his broker to sell for anything he can get. But when the Cosmopolitan tacked on that premium, they were hitting below the belt. It meant that if the price was 90 when I bought, instead of making my ticket "bought steel at 90, it read "bought steel at 91 1/8. Why, that stock could advance 1.25 points after I bought it, and I'd still be losing money if I closed the trade. And by also insisting that I put up a 3-point margin at the very start, they reduced my trading capacity by 2/3. Still, that was the only bucket shop that would take my business at all, and I had to accept their terms or quit trading. Of course, I had my ups and downs, but was a winner on balance. However, the Cosmopolitan people were not satisfied with the awful handicap they had tacked on me, which should have been enough to beat anybody. They tried to double-cross me. They didn't get me. I escaped because of one of my hunches. The Cosmopolitan, as I said, was my last resort. It was the richest bucket shop in New England, and as a rule, they put no limit on a trade. You know how they traded in bucket shops. You gave your money to a clerk and told him what you wished to buy or sell. He looked at the tape or the quotation board and took the price from there. The last one, of course. He also put down the time on the ticket so that it almost read like a regular broker's report. That is, that they had bought or sold for you so many shares of such a stock at such a price at such a time on such a day, and how much money they received from you. When you wished to close your trade, you went to the clerk, the same, or another, it depended on the shop, and you told him. He took the last price, or if the stock had not been active, he waited for the next quotation that came out on the tape. He wrote that price and the time on your ticket, okayed it, and gave it back to you. And then you went to the cashier and got whatever cash it called for. Of course, when the market went against you and the price went beyond the limit set by your margin, your trade automatically closed itself, and your ticket became one more scrap of paper. But the Cosmopolitan was the finest in New England. It had thousands of patrons, and I really think I was the only man they were afraid of. Neither the killing premium nor the 3-point margin they made me put up reduced my trading much. I kept on buying and selling as much as they'd let me. I sometimes had a line of 5,000 shares. Well, on the day the thing happened that I'm going to tell you, I was short 3,500 shares of sugar. I had 7 big pink tickets for 500 shares each. The Cosmopolitan used big slips with a blank space on them where they could write down additional margin. Well, this day I remember I had up over $10,000 in margins. I had put out my 3,500 shares of sugar at 105 1/4. There was another fellow in the room, Henry Williams, who was short 2,500 shares. I used to sit by the ticker and call out the quotations for the board boy. The price behaved as I thought it would. It promptly went down a couple of points and paused a little to get its breath before taking another dip. The general market was pretty soft and everything looked promising. Then, all of a sudden, I didn't like the way sugar was doing its hesitating. I began to feel uncomfortable. I thought I ought to get out of the market. Then it sold at 103. That was low for the day, but instead of feeling more confident, I felt more uncertain. I knew something was wrong somewhere, but I couldn't spot it exactly. But if something was coming and I didn't know where from, I couldn't be on my guard against it. That being the case, I'd better get out of the market. I called to a fellow I knew, Dave Wyman, and said to him, "Dave, you take my place here. I want you to do something for me. Wait a little before you call out the next price of sugar, will you?" He said he would, and I got up and gave him my place by the ticker so he could call out the prices for the boy. I took my 7 sugar tickets out of my pocket and walked over to the counter, to where the clerk was who marked the tickets when you closed your trades. But I didn't really know why I should get out of the market, so I just stood there, leaning against the counter, my tickets in my hands so that the clerk couldn't see them. Pretty soon I heard the clicking of a telegraph instrument, and I saw Tom Burnham, the clerk, turn his head quickly and listen. Then I felt that something crooked was hatching, and I decided not to wait any longer. Just then, Dave Wyman, by the ticker, began, "Sure," and quick as a flash I slapped my tickets on the counter in front of the clerk and yelled, "Close sugar!" before Dave had finished calling the price. So, of course, the house had to close my sugar at the last quotation. What Dave called turned out to be 103 again. According to my dope, sugar should have broken 103 by now. The engine wasn't hitting right. I had the feeling that there was a trap in the neighborhood. At all events, the telegraph instrument was now going like mad, and I noticed that. Tom Burnham, the clerk, had left my tickets unmarked where I laid them and was listening to the clicking as if he were waiting for something, so I yelled at him, "Hey, Tom! What in the hell are you waiting for? Mark the price on these tickets. 103. Get a gate on." So Tom looked sulky, but came over and marked my tickets, closed at 103, and shoved the 7 of them over toward me. He sure had a sour face. Say, the distance from Tom's place to the cashier's cage wasn't over 8 feet. But I hadn't got to the cashier to get my money when Dave Wyman by the ticker yelled excitedly, "Gosh! Sugar! 108! But it was too late. So I just laughed and called over to Tom, "It didn't work that time, did it, old boy?" Of course, it was a put-up job. Henry Williams and I together were short 6,000 shares of sugar. That bucket shop had my margin and Henry's, and there may have been a lot of other sugar shorts in the office, possibly 8 or 10,000 shares in all. Suppose they had $20,000 in sugar margins. That was enough to pay the shop to thimble-rig the market on the New York Stock Exchange and wipe us out. In the old days, whenever a bucket shop found itself loaded with too many bulls on a certain stock, it was a common practice to get some broker to wash down the price of that particular stock far enough to wipe out all the customers that were long of it. This seldom cost the bucket shop more than a couple of points on a few hundred shares, and they made thousands of dollars. That was what the Cosmopolitan did to get me and Henry Williams and the other sugar shorts. Their brokers in New York ran up the price to 108. Of course, it fell right back, but Henry and a lot of others were wiped out. Whenever there was an unexplained sharp drop which was followed by instant recovery, the newspapers in those days used to call it a bucket shop drive. Between the discovery that the Cosmopolitan Stock Brokerage Company was ready to beat me by foul means if the killing handicap of a 3-point margin and a 1.5-point premium didn't do it, and hints that they didn't want my business anyhow, I soon made up my mind to go to New York, where I could trade in the office of some member of the New York Stock Exchange. I didn't want any Boston branch where the quotations had to be telegraphed. I wanted to be close to the original source. I came to New York at the age of 21, bringing with me all I had, $2,500. I had $10,000 when I was 20, and my margin on that sugar deal was over $10,000, but I didn't always win. My plan of trading was sound enough and won oftener than it lost. If I had stuck to it, I'd have been right perhaps as often as 7 out of 10 times. In fact, I always made money when I was sure I was right before I began. Whenever I read the tape by the light of experience, I made money. But when I made a plain fool play, I had to lose. I was only a kid, remember? Anyhow, I came to New York with $2,500. The main thing at the start was to find a place where I wouldn't have to worry about getting a square deal. So, I went to a New York Stock Exchange house that had a branch at home where I knew some of the clerks. They have long since gone out of business. I wasn't there long. Didn't like one of the partners. And then I went to A.R. Fullerton and Company. Somebody must have told them about my early experiences because it was not long before they all got to calling me the boy trader. I've always looked young. It was a handicap in some ways, but it compelled me to fight for my own because so many tried to take advantage of my youth. The chaps at the bucket shops, seeing what a kid I was, always thought I was a fool for luck and that was the only reason why I beat them so often. Well, it wasn't 6 months before I was broke. I was a pretty active trader and had a sort of reputation as a winner. I guess my commissions amounted to something. I ran up my account quite a little, but of course in the end I lost. I played carefully, but I had to lose. I'll tell you the reason. It was my remarkable success in the bucket shops. I could beat the game my way only in a bucket shop, where I was betting on fluctuations. My tape reading had to do with that exclusively. When I bought, the price was there on the quotation board right in front of me. Even before I bought, I knew exactly the price I'd have to pay for my stock, and I always could sell on the instant. I could scalp successfully because I could move like lightning. I could follow up my luck or cut my loss in a second. At all events, what was a perfect system for trading in bucket shops didn't work in Fullerton's office. There, I was actually buying and selling stocks. The price of sugar on the tape might be $1.05, and I could see a 3-point drop coming. As a matter of fact, at the very moment the ticker was printing $1.05 on the tape, the real price on the floor of the exchange might be $1.04 or $1.03. By the time my order to sell 1,000 shares got to Fullerton's floor man to execute, the price might be still lower. I couldn't tell at what price I had put out my 1,000 shares until I got a report from the clerk. When I surely would have made $3,000 on the same transaction in a bucket shop, I might not make a cent in a stock exchange house. I lost in New York because the game was altogether different. It was not that I now was playing it legitimately that made me lose, but that I was playing it ignorantly. I've been told that I am a good reader of the tape. But reading the tape like an expert did not save me. In short, I did not know the game of stock speculation. There were times when my system worked beautifully, and then, all of a sudden, nothing but one swat after another. I was only 22, remember. Not that I was so stuck on myself that I didn't want to know just where I was at fault, but that, at that age, nobody knows much of anything. The people in the office were very nice to me. I couldn't plunge as I wanted to because of their margin requirements. But old A.R. Fullerton and the rest of the firm were so kind to me that after 6 months of active trading, I not only lost all I had brought and all that I had made there, but I even owed the firm a few hundreds. There I was, a mere kid, who had never before been away from home, flat broke. But I knew there wasn't anything wrong with me, only with my play. I don't know whether I make myself plain, but I never lose my temper over the stock market. I never argue with the tape. Getting sore at the market doesn't get you anywhere. I was so anxious to resume trading that I didn't lose a minute, but went to old man Fullerton and said to him, "Say, A.R., lend me $500. "What for?" says he. "I gotta have some money." "What for?" he says again. "For margin, of course," I said.
$500, he said and frowned. "You know they'd expect you to keep up a 10% margin, and that means $1,000 on 100 shares. Much better to give you a credit."
"No," I said. "I don't want a credit here. I already owe the firm something. What I want is for you to lend me $500 so I can go out and get a roll and come back."
"How are you going to do it?" asked old A.R.
"I'll go and trade in a bucket shop," I told him.
"Trade here," he said.
"No," I said. "I'm not sure yet that I can beat the game in this office. but I am sure I can take money out of the bucket shops. I know that game. I have a notion that I know just where I went wrong here. He let me have it. And I went out of that office where the boy terror of the bucket shops, as they called him, had lost his pile. I couldn't go back home because the shops there would not take my business. New York was out of the question. There weren't any doing business at that time. So, after some thinking, I decided to go to St. Louis. I had heard of two concerns there that did an enormous business all through the Middle West. Their profits must have been huge. They had branch offices in dozens of towns. In fact, I'd been told that there were no concerns in the East to compare with them for volume of business. They ran openly, and the best people traded there without any qualms. When I got to St. Louis, I went to the hotel, washed up, and went out to find the bucket shops. One was the J.G. Dolan Company, and the other was H.S. Teller and Company. I knew I could beat them. Dolan was nearer than Teller, and I went there first. I was hoping I might be allowed to do business a few days before they told me to take my trade somewhere else. I walked in. It was a whopping big place, and there must have been at least a couple of hundred people there staring at the quotations. I was glad, because in such a crowd I stood a better chance of being unnoticed. I stood and watched the board, and looked them over carefully, until I picked out the stock for my initial play. I looked around and saw the order clerk at the window where you put down your money and get your ticket. He was looking at me, so I walked up to him and asked, "Is this where you trade in cotton and wheat?" "Yes, sonny," says he. "Can I buy stocks, too?" "You can if you have the cash," he said. "Oh, I got that all right," I said, like a boasting boy. "You have you?" he says, with a smile. "How much stock can I buy for $100? I asked, peeved-like. "100, if you got the 100." "I got the 100, yes, and 200, too," I told him. "Oh, my," he said. "Just you buy me 200 shares," I said, sharply. 200 what?" he asked. Serious now. It was business. I looked at the board again, as if to guess wisely, and told him, 200 Omaha. "All right," he said. He took my money, counted it, and wrote out the ticket. "What's your name?" he asked me, and I answered, "Horace Kent." He gave me the ticket, and I went away and sat down among the customers to wait for the roll to grow. I got quick action, and I traded several times that day. On the next day, too. In 2 days, I made $2,800, and I was hoping they'd let me finish the week out. On the morning of the third day, when I went to the window, bashful-like, to buy 500 BRT, the clerk said to me, "Say, Mr. Kent, the boss, wants to see you." I knew the game was up, but I asked him, "What does he want to see me about?" "I don't know." "Where is he?" "In his private office. Go in that way." And he pointed to a door. I went in. Dolan was sitting at his desk. He swung around and said, "Sit down, Livingston." He pointed to a chair. My last hope vanished. I don't know how he discovered who I was. Perhaps from the hotel register. "What do you want to see me about?" I asked him. "Listen, kid, I ain't got nothing agin you, see? Nothing at all. I seen you come in the day before yesterday, and I didn't like your looks. On the level, I didn't. I spotted you for a ringer. I don't grudge it you, my boy, but the safe is locked for you." "Look here," I began. "You look here, Livingston," he said. "I've heard all about you. I make my money coppering suckers' bets, and you don't belong here, so toddle along, sonny." I left Dolan's place with my $2,800 profit. Teller's place was in the same block. I had found out that Teller was a very rich man, who also ran up a lot of pool rooms. I decided to go to his bucket shop. It wasn't as big a place as Dolan's, but the fixtures were nicer, and evidently the crowd was of a better class. This suited me down to the ground, and I decided to buy 1,000 BRT. So I stepped up to the proper window and said to the clerk, "I'd like to buy some BRT. What's the limit?" "There's no limit," said the clerk. "You can buy all you please. You got the money." "Buy 1,500 shares," I says. and took my roll from my pocket while the clerk starts to write the ticket. Then I saw a red-headed man just shove that clerk away from the counter. He leaned across and said to me,
"Say, Livingston, you go back to Dolan's. We don't want your business."
"Wait until I get my ticket," I said.
"I just bought a little BRT. You get no ticket here," he said. "Don't ever come here to trade. We don't take your business, understand?"
There was no sense in getting mad or trying to argue, so I went back to the hotel, paid my bill, and took the first train back to New York. It was tough. I wanted to take back some real money, and that teller wouldn't let me make even one trade. I got back to New York, paid Fullerton his $500, and started trading again with the St. Louis money. I had good and bad spells, but I was doing better than breaking even. After all, I didn't have much to unlearn, only to grasp the one fact that there was more to the game of stock speculation than I had considered before I went to Fullerton's office to trade. I was like one of those puzzle fans, doing the crossword puzzles in the Sunday supplement. He wasn't satisfied until he gets it. Well, I certainly wanted to find the solution to my puzzle. It takes a man a long time to learn all the lessons of all his mistakes. They say there are two sides to everything, but there is only one side to the stock market, and it is not the bull side or the bear side, but the right side. It took me longer to get that general principle fixed firmly in my mind than it did most of the more technical phases of the game of stock speculation. With me, I must back my opinions with my money. My losses have taught me that I must not begin to advance until I am sure I shall not have to retreat. But if I cannot advance, I do not move at all. I do not mean by this that a man should not limit his losses when he is wrong. He should. But that should not breed indecision. All my life I have made mistakes, but in losing money I have gained experience and accumulated a lot of valuable don'ts. I have been flat broke several times, but my loss has never been a total loss. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here now. I always knew I would have another chance and that I would not make the same mistake a second time. I believed in myself. A man must believe in himself and his judgment if he expects to make a living at this game. That is why I don't believe in tips. If I buy stocks on Smith's tip, I must sell those same stocks on Smith's tip. I am depending on him. Suppose Smith is away on a holiday when the selling time comes around. No, sir. Nobody can make big money on what someone else tells him to do. I know from experience that nobody can give me a tip or a series of tips that will make more money for me than my own judgment. It took me 5 years to learn to play the game intelligently enough to make big money when I was right. My task, as I should have known after my early reverses at Fullerton's, was very simple: to look at speculation from another angle. But I didn't know that there was much more to the game than I could possibly learn in the bucket shops. There, I thought I was beating the game when in reality, I was only beating the shop. At the same time, the tape-reading ability that trading in bucket shops developed in me and the training of my memory had been extremely valuable. Both of these things came easy to me. I owe my early success as a trader to them and not to brains or knowledge, because my mind was untrained and my ignorance was colossal. The game taught me the game, and it didn't spare the rod while teaching. I remember my very first day in New York. One of the boys in the office where I got my first job was working for Harding Brothers, members of the New York Stock Exchange. I arrived in this city in the morning, and before 1 o'clock that same day I had opened an account with the firm and was ready to trade. They were having some pretty lively times those days, and the market was very active. That always cheers up a fellow. I felt at home right away. There was the old familiar quotation board in front of me, talking a language that I had learned before I was 15 years old. There was a boy doing exactly the same thing I used to do in the first office I ever worked. There were the customers, same old bunch, looking at the board or standing by the ticket, calling out the prices and talking about the market. The machinery was to all appearances the same machinery that I was used to. The atmosphere was the atmosphere I had breathed since I had made my first stock market money, $3.12 in Burlington. The same kind of ticker and the same kind of traders, therefore the same kind of game. And remember, I was only 22. I suppose I thought I knew the game from A to Z. Why shouldn't I? I watched the board and saw something that looked good to me. It was behaving right. I bought 100 at 84. I got out at 85 in less than a half hour. Then I saw something else I liked, and I did the same thing, took 3/4 of a point net within a very short time. I began well, didn't I? Now, mark this. On that, my first day as a customer of a reputable stock exchange house, and only 2 hours of it at that, I traded in 1,100 shares of stock, jumping in and out. And the net result of the day's operations was that I lost exactly $1,100. That is to say, on my first attempt, nearly one half of my stake went up the flue. And remember, some of the trades showed me a profit. But I quit $1,100 minus for the day. It didn't worry me because I couldn't see where there was anything wrong with me. My moves, also, were right enough, and if I'd been trading in the old Cosmopolitan shop, I'd have broken better than even. That machine wasn't as it ought to be. My 1,100 vanished dollars plainly told me. But as long as the machinist was all right, there was no need to stew. Ignorance at 22 isn't a structural defect. After a few days, I said to myself, I can't trade this way here. The ticker doesn't help as it should. But I let it go at that without getting down to bedrock. I kept it up, having good days and bad days until I was cleaned out. I went to old Fullerton and got him to stake me to $500, and I came back from St. Louis, as I told you, with money I took out of the bucket shops there, a game I could always beat. I played more carefully and did better for a while. As soon as I was in easy circumstances, I began to live pretty well. I made friends and had a good time. I was not quite 23, remember, all alone in New York with easy money in my pockets and the belief in my heart that I was beginning to understand the new machine. I was making allowances for the actual execution of my orders on the floor of the exchange and moving more cautiously. But I was still sticking to the tape. That is, I was still ignoring general principles, and as long as I did that, I could not spot the exact trouble with my game. We ran into the big boom of 1901, and I made a great deal of money. That is, for a boy. You remember those times? The prosperity of the country was unprecedented. We not only ran into an era of industrial consolidations and combinations of capital that beat anything we had had up to that time, but the public went stock mad. Everybody was making money. The steel crowd came to town, a horde of millionaires with no more regard for money than drunken sailors. The only game that satisfied them was the stock market. We had some of the biggest high rollers the street ever saw, John W. Gates of Bet You a Million fame, and his friends like John A. Drake, Loyal Smith, and the rest, the Reedsley's Moore crowd, who sold part of their steel holdings and with the proceeds bought in the open market the actual majority of the stock of the great Rock Island system, and Schwab and Frick and Phipps and the Pittsburgh Coterie. And there were some wonderful winnings, and no taxes to pay on stock sales, and no day of reckoning in sight. I knew, of course, there must be a limit to the advances, and an end to the crazy buying of AOT, any old thing, and I got bearish. But every time I sold, I lost money, and if it hadn't been that I ran darn quick, I'd have lost a heap more. I looked for a break, but I was playing safe, making money when I bought and chipping it out when I sold short, so that I wasn't profiting by the boom as much as you'd think when you consider how heavily I used to trade, even as a boy. There was one stock that I wasn't short of, and that was Northern Pacific. My tape reading came in handy. I thought most stocks had been bought to a standstill, but Little Nipper behaved as if it were going still higher. Well, I was long 1,000 shares of Northern Pacific Common, and held it against the advice of everybody in the office. When it got to about 110, I had 30 points profit, and I grabbed it. It made my balance at my broker's nearly $50,000, the greatest amount of money I'd been able to accumulate up to that time. Wasn't so bad for a chap who'd lost every cent trading in that self-same office a few months before. There I was, on the morning of May 9th, with nearly $50,000 in cash and no stocks. I had been very bearish for some days, and here was my chance at last. I knew what would happen, an awful break and then some wonderful bargains. There would be a quick recovery and big profits for those who had picked up the bargains. It didn't take a Sherlock Holmes to figure this out. We were going to have an opportunity to catch them coming and going, not only for big money, but for sure money. Everything happened as I had foreseen. I was dead right, and I lost every cent I had. I was wiped out by something that was unusual. The market fairly boiled, as I had expected. The transactions were enormous, and the fluctuations unprecedented in extent. I put in a lot of selling orders at the market. When I saw the opening prices, I had a fit. The breaks were so awful. My brokers were on the job. They were as competent and conscientious as any, but by the time they executed my orders, the stocks had broken 20 points or more. The tape was way behind the market, and reports were slow in coming in by reason of the awful rush of business. When I found out that the stocks I had ordered sold when the tape said the price was, say, 100, and they got mine off at 80, making a total decline of 30 or 40 points from the previous night's close, it seemed to me that I was putting out shorts at a level that made the stocks I sold the very bargains I had planned to buy. The market was not going to drop right through to China, so I decided instantly to cover my shorts and go long. My brokers bought, not at the level that had made me turn, but at the prices prevailing in the stock exchange when their floor man got my orders. They paid an average of 15 points more than I had figured on. A loss of 35 points in one day was more than anybody could stand. The ticker beat me by lagging so far behind the market. I was accustomed to regarding the tape as the best little friend I had because I bet according to what it told me. But this time, the tape double-crossed me. The divergence between the printed and the actual prices undid me. I kept on trading in and out, regardless of the execution. You see, I never could trade with a limit. I must take my chances with the market. This is what I am trying to beat. The market, not the particular price. When I think I should sell, I sell. When I think stocks will go up, I buy. My adherence to that general principle of speculation saved me. To have traded at limited prices simply would have been my old bucket shop method, inefficiently adapted for use in a reputable commission broker's office. I would never have learned to know what stock speculation is, but would have kept on betting on what a limited experience told me was a sure thing. Whenever I did try to limit the prices in order to minimize the disadvantages of trading at the market when the ticker lagged, I simply found that the market got away from me. Early that fall, I not only was cleaned out again, but I was so sick of the game I could no longer beat that I decided to leave New York and try something some other place. I'd been trading since my 14th year. I had made my first $1,000 when I was a kid of 15 and my first $10,000 before I was 21. I had made and lost a $10,000 stake more than once. In New York, I had made thousands and lost them. I got up to $50,000, and 2 days later that went. I had no other business and knew no other game. After several years, I was back where I began. No, worse, for I had acquired habits and a style of living that required money, though that part didn't bother me as much as being wrong so consistently. Well, I went home. But the moment I was back, I knew that I had but one mission in life, and that was to get a stake and go back to Wall Street. That was the only place in the country where I could trade heavily. Some day, when my game was all right, I'd need such a place. When a man is right, he wants to get all that is coming to him for being right. I didn't have much hope, but of course I tried to get into the bucket shops again. There were fewer of them, and some of them were run by strangers. Those who remembered me wouldn't give me a chance to show them whether I had gone back as a trader or not. I told them the truth, that I had lost in New York whatever I had made at home, that I didn't know as much as I used to think I did, and that there was no reason why it should not now be good business for them to let me trade with them. But they wouldn't. One day I was in a hotel lobby talking to some fellows I knew who were pretty steady traders. Everybody was talking about the stock market. I made the remark that nobody could beat the game on account of the rotten execution he got from his brokers, especially when he traded at the market, as I did. A fellow piped up and asked me what particular brokers I meant. I said, the best in the land, and he asked who might they be. I could see he wasn't going to believe I ever dealt with first-class houses, but I said, I mean any member of the New York Stock Exchange. It isn't that they are crooked or careless, but when a man gives an order to buy at the market, he never knows what that stock is going to cost him until he gets a report from the brokers. There are more moves of 1 or 2 points than of 10 or 15, but the outside trader can't catch the small rises or drops because of the execution. I'd rather trade in a bucket shop any day of the week, if they'd only let a fellow trade big. The man who had spoken to me I had never seen before. His name was Roberts. He seemed very friendly disposed. He took me aside and asked me if I had ever traded in any of the other exchanges, and I said no. He said he knew some houses that were members of the Cotton Exchange and the Produce Exchange and the smaller stock exchanges. These firms were very careful and paid special attention to the execution. He said that they had confidential connections with the biggest and smartest houses on the New York Stock Exchange, and through their personal pull, and by guaranteeing a business of hundreds of thousands of shares a month, they got much better service than an individual customer could get. They really cater to the small customer, he said. They make a specialty of out-of-town business, and they take just as much pains with a 10-share order as they do with one for 10,000. They are very competent and honest. Yes, but if they pay the stock exchange house the regular 8th commission, where do they come in? Well, they're supposed to pay the 8th, but, you know. He winked at me. Yes, I said, but the one thing a stock exchange firm will not do is to split commissions. The governors would rather a member committed murder, arson, and bigamy than to do business for outsiders for less than a kosher 8th. The very life of the stock exchange depends upon their not violating that one rule. He must have seen that I had talked with stock exchange people, for he said, listen, every now and then one of those pious stock exchange houses is suspended for a year for violating that rule, isn't it? There are ways and ways of rebating so no one can squeal. He probably saw unbelief in my face, for he went on, and besides, on certain kind of business, these wirehouses, charge a 32nd extra in addition to the 8th commission. They are very nice about it. They never charge the extra commission except in unusual cases, and then only if the customer has an inactive account. It wouldn't pay them, you know, otherwise. They aren't in business exclusively for their health. By that time, I knew he was touting for some phony brokers. Do they trade in the same stocks that are dealt in on the New York Stock Exchange? Of course. And on the curb, and on any other exchange in this country or Europe. They deal in wheat, cotton, provisions, anything you want. They have correspondents everywhere and memberships in all the exchanges, either in their own name or on the quiet. What's the name of the firm? I asked him. He told me. I had heard about them. They ran ads in all the papers, calling attention to the great profits made by those customers who followed their inside information on active stocks. That was the firm's great specialty. They were not a regular bucket shop, but bucketeers, alleged brokers who bucketed their orders but nevertheless went through an elaborate camouflage to convince the world that they were regular brokers engaged in a legitimate business. They were one of the oldest of that class of firms. These people used to send out tips to buy or sell a certain stock, hundreds of telegrams advising the instant purchase of a certain stock, and hundreds recommending other customers to sell the same stock, on the old racing tipster plan. Then orders to buy and sell would come in. The firm would buy and sell, say, 1,000 of that stock through a reputable stock exchange firm and get a regular report on it.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.